Okay. Somebody tell me, please, what have I said is the key verse in this book, if there is a key verse? If there is a key verse, what is it? Chapter 1, verse 7. And why is that the key verse? Chapter 1, verse 7 reads, "Behold, he's coming with the clouds, and every eye will see him, even those who pierced him, and all tribes of the earth will wail or mourn on account of him. Even so, amen." Sorry, a little bit louder. It is in the present tense. There's not so much time indicators in this verse, but we have other time indicators in the first couple of verses. Those are important too. This is happening soon. Verse 3, "Blessed is he who reads, the time is near." But verse 7 nails down some... Yes, Bob. He is coming. There is, like Debbie said, there is that present tense. But what else about this verse makes it so crucial to a proper placing of the events that are taking place? John? There's a direct reference to they who pierced him. There's something here that localizes this in the events that would have happened within the lifetime of the author of the book. And even more importantly, or just as important, the language, "he's coming with clouds," is something that harkens back to Jesus' own proclamation in the Olivet Discourse in Matthew 24, and that itself harkens back to earlier proclamations of the Old Testament prophets who used this cloud imagery to talk about the impending judgment of God. It was symbolic imagery. Nobody believed God was going to, or Jehovah was going to get on a cloud and swoop down into Egypt. It was a metaphorical way of speaking of God's judgment coming. Bob, did you have another thing? That further localizes it, all the tribes of the land. Now, I went into some detail, if you remember, to say why I believe, and many others, that the proper translation of that is the land, not the earth. Now, the word there can mean earth, but when we talk about tribes in the Bible, everywhere you look, almost always, that's a reference to the tribes of Israel. Another localization, another bringing it down to a particular time and place. All right, now we have gone on through the first chapter, and today we're going to get into the second chapter. But I want to focus on one more verse in chapter 1, verse 19. Well, let's start with verse 17. John says, "When I saw him, I fell at his feet as though dead, but he laid his right hand on me, saying, 'Fear not, I am the first and the last and the living one. I died, and behold, I am alive forevermore, and I have the keys of death and Hades.'" Now, this describes the resultant physical reaction that John has in the experience of this first vision that comes to him, this fantastic vision of the reigning, triumphant Christ. What does he do? He falls down as if he died. This is one of many places that we have in the Bible where an encounter with God gives this kind of physical reaction. Well, as a matter of fact, every place that we have recorded where there's some sort of an encounter between God's holy presence, whether it be a vision of the risen Christ or the angel of the Lord, you know, the thing is, you don't have people swaying back and forth with their arms in the air saying, Jesus be my best friend. They fall down as if they're dead. They can't speak. There's awe. There's a tremendous, almost a horror that comes over them. I don't mean in a macabre sense on this Halloween Sunday, but in a sense of unworthiness, a sense of godly fear. You don't find this sort of chummy type of reaction that we often get from the contemporary church's attitude toward the Lord. Now, it says here that he laid his right hand upon me. Does anybody want to take a stab as to why that's significant? What would that mean, the laying on of the right hand upon him? What could it possibly mean here in this context? Truth? No, I don't think it means that. I mean, it doesn't mean falsehood, but how would laying a right hand on him mean truth? I'm not sure. Now, this is Jesus laying his right hand on John. That's certainly one thing it could mean. It's a sign of consolation and reassurance. What do we do when we have new elders and deacons to ordain? We lay hands on them. And so this also could function, in addition to that, as some sort of commissioning of John in what he's about to be doing. The words that the Lord there speaks to him are further confirmation of the Lord's power and authority. He is the first and the last. Now, if you look back up at verse 8, that's sort of another way of saying I'm the Alpha and Omega. It recalls the same thing. He is alive from the dead, and in point of fact, he is alive eternally, forevermore. Now, having the keys of death and Hades is another indication of Jesus' power and authority. If he's got the keys of life and death, well, then that's the highest authority that you can have. And it's also a further confirmation of his king-like authority. A king is the one in the ancient world who determines life and death. And having these keys is symbolic of that. On the other hand, you should know that this is something of a very curious and unusual reference, because typically in the ancient world, at least in terms of the writings of the Hebrews and early Christians, neither death nor Hades are generally spoken of in Scripture as being accessible by keys. Now, I won't go into any more detail of that, but just to say that that is something that is noteworthy or unusual about this reference. Now let's move on to verse 19. Now write what you see, and I'd like to check my other translation here. Let me read it from the ESV. Write therefore the things that you have seen, those that are, and those that are to take place after this. Does somebody read it from the New King James Version? Just that part of verse 19. Well, that's all of verse 19. Does anybody have anything different from the two versions that have been read? Margaret? Okay. Now, the futurist schools of interpretation, and by the way, for those of you who are diligent in keeping your handouts, I gave you, I think, the very first class, a little sheet of paper that gave you the interpretive models of the book of Revelation. And at the top, it lists the preterist, the idealist, the historicist, the futurist. And just so you'll know what we're talking about, concerning the historicist and the futurist, they both see these things that are being spoken of as largely taking place either totally in the future or progressively being fulfilled throughout the history of the church. And in those methods, for the futurist and the historicist school, this is a very crucial verse. And the standard view among those who advocate this method of the historicist or futurist school is that this verse indicates a threefold division of ages concerning the past, the present, and the future. And it indicates that while John is being shown things that concern his past and his present, the things that take place hereafter are concerning things that will happen far into the future. Now, that's what the futurist and the historicist say. Now, let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. This is a book called The Present Reign of Jesus Christ, a Historical Interpretation of the Book of Revelation by Robert Carignolan. This is one of the few recently written books on the historicist view of the book of Revelation. Now, the book that some of you bought, End Times Delusions, Steve Wahlberg, the author of that book, he holds to the historicist view. But that book is not really a commentary on Revelation. But if you have started reading that, you'll start to get a flavor of what I'm going to be mentioning to you right now. But let me read you what Carignola says about this. He says, Revelation chapter 2 and 3 differ from the other chapters in the prophecy. In them, the Lord dictates seven letters to the seven churches, which have been selected to represent the entire Christian church in its sevenfold historical development. And that's why when we get into the first of the seven churches here in just a moment, I'm going to give you a handout that you can see they have this. The historicist school had it all charted out, where one of the seven churches represents one age and one time frame, the other represents another age, and you'll see what I'm talking about there. So for them, this is a very crucial verse. And the things that are to happen after this, they say, have no contemporary relevance to John, except insofar as the first church, the church at Ephesus, did talk about things that might have been in his lifetime, but all the others are talking about things that go far into the distant future. Now, it can be readily seen that this kind of understanding of verse 19 fits well, very well, with the futurist and the historicist methods. If we take a look at the grammar of the verse, along with the proper reading of it in the light of the already established context, it really requires a very different interpretation than what either the historicist or the futurist say. First of all, it certainly is the case that verse 19 does in fact refer to John's being told to write down things relating to the past, present, and future. I mean, that's obvious in all the different translations that we read of this verse. The boundaries of the future part of the vision, though, have already been delimited. They've already been set for us. They've already been outlined by the time texts of the earlier parts of the chapter. The author stipulates in verse 1 that he is to be shown things, and by inference, that means the things described in the visions, the seven visions, and this is the first of the seven, he's going to be shown things that are soon to take place. And underlining and reinforcing that statement is the time text from verse 3, chapter 1, verse 3, that reminds the reader, for the time is near. And surely, I think there must be a connection between, who read, you read, and I think we were, read yours again, read verse 19 again. All right, now if you look up at verse 3, verse 1, if you look up at verse 1, notice the things that must soon take place. So we've got the things that are soon to take place and the things that are to happen in the past, present, and future. And I think surely there's a connection between the things to be shown in verse 1 and the things to be written down in verse 19. I mean, it's almost the same. It is the same word. Now, some of the translations have it a little differently, but reading the word things into it is quite proper in terms of the Greek language. And on that much alone, I think there's good evidence to support the idea that what the things that are to take place after this do not refer to events occurring in the distant future, but rather the immediate and near future of the writer and his contemporaries. But now, secondly, as far as the grammatical formula of verse 19, we have this wording, and I've put it in the Greek for a particular reason, kai ha mele genestai meta tauta, the things that are to take place after this. Now, this is a key word here, this word mele. This word is pronounced melo. This is the root word. And I've written the grammatical formula for it here. It's in the present active indicative. Anybody, an English grammar scholar in here? Somebody tell me what the present active indicative means? Well, I wouldn't know either unless I had looked it up. It means something that's about to be. There is a strong, strong immediacy in this word and in that tense. As a matter of fact, how many of you have heard of Young's literal translation or Young's concordance? Some of you have. This is a literal, almost word-for-word translation of the entire Bible, and it's still used today. It was a monument of scholarship in its day. And if you consult Young's literal translation, that's the way he translates this verse. the things that are about to take place. And as I said, the lexical dictionary definition does support the idea of the nearness and the immediacy of something, of an event, and Young's literal translation gives it that way. Now, among people who take the approach that I'm taking to this book, and by the way, this would be a good place for me to remind you, that what I'm presenting to you is one of only a myriad possible approaches to this book of Revelation. Now, I've said that I think the historicists and the futurists are wrong about this. Well, they could poke holes in some of the things I'm going to present to you. I think when it's all said and done, as convincing as whoever, if I were, heaven forbid, Jack Van Impe standing up here presenting it to you, I could be very convincing, even if I didn't have the lovely Rex Allo with me. We do have some Jack Van Impe fans in here, don't we? How many of you have no idea who the lovely Rex Allo is? Okay, well, that's just as well. She is aging well, though, isn't she, for those of you who know? I'm under this because I was watching it on TV this morning. They could present to you a seemingly an ironclad argument, I'm sure. And so I think that when it's all said and done, we have to hold our position with a certain amount of tentativeness, because this book was written almost 2,000 years ago. We weren't there. We can't go anywhere and find the original copy with John's, or whoever wrote it, if it wasn't John, whoever wrote it, with the original commentary as to what exactly he meant. That is a big ditch that we can't get across. And so anybody who's going to tell you this is absolutely ironclad the case, I want to try to remember to say this, because no matter which way you cut this, no matter which way you go with this in the end, you're going to have some problems. What I've tried to do is decide what problems can I ultimately live with. Now, you may not be able to live with the same problems I'm able to live with, and vice versa. But I think ultimately what we want to try to do is find out what this meant in its context, what would have made the most sense to the people who were the original audience. Now, one thing that happens among people who take this approach, the general approach that I'm presenting to you, which is that this is largely, if not completely, all of it, the book of Revelation is either largely, or some people would say completely, fulfilled in the past. They point to this word, mellow, and its various forms, melee in this sentence, and they will hang almost the entire argument on this word. See, it means about to be. They'll look it up and back a Strong's Concordance, so they'll maybe be a little more sophisticated than that and find some Greek dictionary, and they'll get Young's literal translation. Well, it means about to be. It's about to be. And that raises an interesting question. If it's so ironclad clear to everybody, why don't the translations say that in the various English translations? And that shows that this argument is open to a criticism. And this is the case not only with this word, but we run into this problem in Protestant evangelical Reformed Christian circles with proof texting a lot of things in the Bible, is that people will take a static lexical dictionary definition of a word that they find in a dictionary, and they'll decide, okay, well, this is what it means in all times, in all places, in all contexts. And I think that the people who take this point of view that I'm presenting to you are open to the criticism that you can't hang all of this on the dictionary definition meaning of one particular word. That is a valid criticism. But I don't think, in this case, it negates the validity of the argument that John's, the things that are about to take place or to take place hereafter, I don't think it negates the argument that were going to take place in the immediate future of John and his contemporaries. If there were no other lexical or grammatical support for placing all of the interpretive weight on mele, there might be some force, there might be some justification to the criticism. But as I think, or at least I've tried to demonstrate, there are other time texts, there are other indicators in these verse, in this, than just what we have here in verse 19, that have already set the stage of the contemporary setting of the events that are about to be revealed. And the use of this word mele in verse 19 is nothing more than in keeping with the flow of the chapter as it's been going so far. And as I said, The word is in the present active indicative tense, and that further supports the notion of a contemporary fulfillment. John was to write down those things in the vision that were to unfold before him, and those things concerned the past, the present, and his immediate future. All right, now, let me stop and see if you have any questions to this point, because at this stage we're going to take a little bit of a different turn, because the letters to the seven churches are something of a different character, and I'm only going to tangentially or briefly mention these. You'll find probably that this is the fastest moving part of the class. At least I intend for it to be that way. Whether it winds up being that way, we'll see. Anything before we go on to the next thing? All right. In chapter 2, we begin then the letters to the seven churches. And let me read. Well, let me have somebody else read. You who are listening by way of CD will have to read this for yourself. Chapter 2, verses 1 to 7. Can I have a volunteer to read? I'm recording this. That's why I did that. Can I have a volunteer to read loudly and distinctly without regional accent or dialect? Ruth, I'm sorry to hear that rules me out. It does me too, to some extent. And you too, Cindy. I'm just kidding. Anybody can read it here if you want to. John. Yes. Thank you, John. Now, I want to pass out to you a handout, and I think there should be enough for everybody to have a copy. Now, this is a typical historicist model of how the letters to the seven churches are to be interpreted and how it fits into their scheme and their way of understanding things. I'm focusing on this today because the historicist method is virtually unknown compared to the dispensational futurist method. That's the one you're more likely to come in contact with. But the historicist method has a very distinguished history. Prior to the rise of dispensationalism in the late 1800s and early 1900s, almost all Protestant biblical commentaries that commented on Revelation, they came from more or less this point of view. Matthew Henry's commentary, Albert Barnes' Notes on the New Testament are just two examples that reflect the historicist or historicalist point of view. And that point of view is that Revelation, they say, like the book of Daniel, gives us a vision of future history. And it is history specifically that is going to be progressively fulfilled in specific ages of the history of the church. Now, if you'll look at this handout, you'll see that in the right-hand column, it says Ephesus, pure, hates the Nicolaitans. And if you look over, you'll see it has a date, Pentecost, A.D. 29, the apostolic era. And then you look down to the next on the right column, Smyrna, suffers 10 years of persecution. And you notice in the left column, last apostle about A.D. 100. And as you progressively look down in that left column, you'll see certain historical figures, Constantine, Belisarius takes Rome in 538 A.D. Should be A.D. 538, by the way, since we're focusing on grammar today. Martin Luther, the Pope captured, that was in France, or had something to do with the French Revolution, if I'm not mistaken. World War I, the last days, and then you see each of those things corresponds with one of these seven churches. And that's the typical historicalist approach to this book. And they further go on, and we'll talk about this as we get further into the book. They will focus on like some of the plagues, for example, and the bowls of wrath. They see that being fulfilled in very literal, historical, past events. Just to give you a flavor of how they did that, the plague of locusts, the swarms of locusts, they interpreted that to be the invasion of the Turks, the Ottoman Turks, into Western Europe and Eastern Europe. They were like swarms of locusts. They had very elaborate ways of looking at this. And this was the standard method of interpretation for a long time in the church. And it's made a slight comeback in some circles. But largely, it is not held by most people anymore because people recognize, well, for one thing, well, let me ask you, somebody tell me, what are some of the problems with that point of view, do you think?
Well,
Excuse me? Yeah. It's sort of a retroactive, you know, oh, okay, well, that's what it meant. Okay. John? That's one of the main problems with it. I mean, you'd think that there was nothing else going on anywhere in the history of Christianity except Western Europe. And not surprisingly, this point of view is very, very big with those who hold to the Christian identity British Israel theory, for those of you who know about that. Let me mention three things in particular. I have them listed on the board as we get into the study of the seven churches. First of all, these are letters written to seven real churches. We talked about this at the beginning. I gave you a little chart that had the location of the various cities. I mentioned the old Roman postal route, the direction that a letter would be carried. Now, it's interesting, we don't have any evidence anywhere that these were separate letters. There's no existing Greek manuscript of any age that is just the letter to the church at Ephesus. And then we find 500 years later somebody discovers a copy that's just the letter to the church at Smyrna. They're always together, grouped together. So there's no evidence that these were separate letters that were written to all these separate churches in that sense. Now, they may have been that way, but all we have are copies of this the manuscripts of Revelation in Greek that contain all seven of them together. But they were literal churches, and as we talked about, I think, at the beginning, there were more churches, even in these individual cities, than just one. But seven is a big number in this book, and it represents in some way the fullness of all the churches that existed in that time. Secondly, even though there is a specific historical contemporary context, when we start reading, as you've just heard from what John read, it's talking about specific things that were going on in these churches at the time. He's addressing real problems. But even though that's the case, and to key off on that little aphorism that I suggested you remember, this book is not written to you, it's written for you. The lessons that we can glean from what's being said to these churches are universally applicable. People are sinful, problems always exist, and so some of the things, perhaps all of them, do have a modern application, even though there's no modern correspondence because these churches don't exist anymore. Thirdly, when you study, as we will go through them, you see there's a very clear, definite structure and pattern to each of the letters. Now, let's very quickly talk about what's going on here at the Church of Ephesus. One of the things that characterized the city of Ephesus, it was probably the most important city in the Asia, what was that at that time considered the province of Asia of the Roman Empire. It had one of the most incredible temples of anywhere in the ancient world. I don't know if it was one of the seven wonders of the ancient world or not, but I was doing some reading about this in preparation for the lesson. This temple was as long as two football fields, you can imagine, and just immensely decorated, dedicated to the goddess Artemis or Diana, depending on whether you prefer the Latin or Greek pronunciation. And to that extent, it was a very pagan city. And one of the things that we have begun to learn in more recent archaeological and manuscript study is that although many of these cities had temples and were dedicated to particular gods or goddesses of antiquity, there was one god in particular that the pagans had grown in these provinces to worship more than perhaps any other. And this is something that was very, very crucial to what John was dealing with at the time. Does anybody want to take a guess what that god was? Or who that god was? Small g, of course. John? You take that foot right out of your mouth, because you're right. The worship of Caesar as a god was growing tremendously in the provinces. And I would be remiss in my own conscience in saying that means the worship of the state as God was growing immensely in the provinces. And we will see some of this being reflected in some of this, but the whole point was is that if you were going to be a good Roman citizen, you worship the Roman gods, and chief among them was our great leader, the Caesar. The words of him who holds the seven stars in his right hand, who walks among the seven golden lampstands, He says, I know your works, your toil, and your patient endurance, and how you cannot bear those who are evil, but have tested those who call themselves apostles and are not, and found them to be false. Well, that tells us a lot about this church. They were a hard-working church. They toiled, they labored. And that last part about testing those who call themselves apostles and are not, what does that tell you about them? Anybody? They desired truth. What else does it tell you about what was going on there? There were a lot of false teachers running around. This was a big problem. You see, there again, this is something else that our futurist friends, that our dispensational left behind friends, all of this has got to be happening today. All these false prophets, you know, there's Jim Jones and the David Koresh, and they go on and on, they list all these people. Friends, there were thousands of these kinds of false prophets in the ancient Roman Empire. This was all going on at the time in which this book was being written. Verse 3, I know you are enduring patiently and bearing up for my name's sake. Well, what were they enduring? Persecution. That's already, he's already said, I'm with you in the tribulation. I'm your brother going through this with you. For the sake of Christ, when he says, my name's sake, and that you have not grown weary, they've borne up well, but I have this against you, that you have abandoned the love you had at first. Remember, therefore, from where you have fallen. So, even though they've been very good at this, they've been very focused on these things, there's something that's sort of kind of gone by the wayside. If you are married or have been married, you know that as you go through the stages of marriage, you know, the attitude changes, and you can become so focused on things that are going on in your life or whatever that, you know, you don't invest as much time in that relationship, and some things can start to fall out of it a little bit, or maybe a lot. And it's the same here. It's interesting that he draws on this language. You've got to remember, he says, therefore, from where you have fallen. Where did you start from? Go back to the beginning. Try to recapture that. And he says, notice, repent and do the works you did at first. It's interesting, too, that, and now, you know, in my Bible, this is red letter stuff here. So what does that tell you? Because I've got a bad Bible, right? They should all be black letters. Well, of course, it's supposed to mean it's the words of Jesus, and they are. But notice what he says here. Let me misread it. And see intentionally, see if you can pick up on what's going, the point I'm trying to make. Repent and feel like you did at the beginning. That's not what he says, is it? You see, there's an emphasis on doing works. Well, I thought we weren't supposed to do works. No, you see, faith and works go together. The two things go together. If not, I will come to you. Now, who's he talking to here? He's talking to this church. Here's another contemporary time statement. I'm going to come to you. Now, there is a sense in which he could be talking about Boston Center or any church that becomes guilty of the problem that this church is. But let's not forget, there's a contemporary historical context that's being set here. Is the church that was being addressed in Ephesus, is it still there today? Anybody been to Ephesus? Anybody here been to Turkey? Well, this church isn't there anymore. Look what he says. He says, I will come to you. And interesting, I can't get too far without interrupting myself. I will come. Here is a coming of Jesus. Here is a return of Jesus, in quote, in some sense. You see, you've got this language in here that's not to be taken literally. I will come to you and remove your lampstand from its place unless you repent. There's a threat. There's a promise of covenantal judgment unless things change. Now, do you think when the church at Ephesus heard this, they thought, oh no, Jesus is going to come walking in here and remove our lamps? No, they knew what it meant. They meant they would probably be dealing with some pretty nasty situations, and that this was a metaphorical way of saying that God's judgment would come against them. Yet this you have, you hate the works of the Nicolaitans, which I also hate. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To the one who conquers, I will grant to eat of the tree of life, which is in the paradise of God. Now, the Nicolaitans were an early group. There's some difference of opinion as to exactly who they were, the followers of a particular Nicholas, not the Saint Nicholas of later centuries, but someone who was apparently some sort of teacher who wanted to sort of blend pagan and Christian worship together. And it's interesting here, too. He says, I hate. Here's another little contemporary evangelical mythology of Jesus meek and mild. You know, God hates the sin but loves the sinner. Well, he says here, you hate the works of the Nicolaitans, which I also hate. Well, he hates the works, but it's also clear from the context and the grammar that he hates the Nicolaitans too. He doesn't like them. And that's another thing. I mean, do our works, are they somehow separate from we who do them? The works wouldn't be done if it wasn't for a real live person doing them. How can you separate those two things? Well, that only happens in modern evangelicalism. To the one who conquers, I will grant of the tree, to eat of the tree of life, which is in the paradise of God. Well, what does that make you think of? Where does that come from? The tree of life? The paradise of God? Genesis. Garden of Eden. And we're going to see time and again as we go through this book, we have a lot of this kind of Garden of Eden imagery. Once again, you've got a book that's solidly grounded in Old Testament Hebrew Jewish thinking, not contemporary modern evangelical thinking. And if that's the approach that we take from the very beginning, we're going to get it wrong. Okay, I'm going to conclude with that. As I said, we're going to breeze through this part of it because there's been so much written about and preached on in Sunday school lessons and small group Bible studies about the letters to the seven churches. I don't want to devote a tremendous amount of time to it, not because it's unimportant, but because it's been so common. I mean, nine times out of ten, when somebody preaches through Revelation, they'll go through chapter 3 and stop, just because it's so very good to preach on those things. The applications are wonderful. Beyond that, it just will be a bit of a challenge. Let me see if you have any questions or comments before we... Yes, John.